From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Does philosophy affect public policy? What contributions does philosophy make to the ways in which Americans think and act about issues such as civil rights, the conduct of American foreign policy, the treatment of animals, and our notions of equality and fairness at home and overseas? By way of comment and discussion about such questions, Soundings now presents the views of three scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. They are Michael Bales of the University of Florida, Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University, and Larry Temkin of Rice University. First on this edition of Soundings, a comment by Tom Reagan of North Carolina State University about one specific aspect of the connection between philosophy and public policy, the question of animal rights. Following Tom Reagan's commentary, a discussion about other aspects of philosophy and public policy featuring Michael Bales and Larry Temkin. Tom Reagan is the author of The Case for Animal Rights, published by the University of California Press.
Gandhi said, "You can judge the character of a society by how it treats its animals." We Americans receive low marks given this standard. True, some animals are special, our pets, for example, and maybe baby seals and the California condor. More often than not, however, our moral concern extends only as far as our heart takes it, and few people have hearts that throb over the plight of hogs, chickens, and dairy cattle. For most of us, the body happily eats what the heart habitually ignores. Or consider those animals used in science. Approximately 3 are killed every second in America's laboratories. As our scientists do not protest, who will? Not those who enforce the law, for the law currently is on the side of those who do the killing, not those who are killed. Will the church, then, protest? Not if it keeps to its theology of insecurity, a theology that attempts to puff up the importance of humans by systematically deflating the value of everything else. The lamb, we are told, takes pleasure in the knowledge that she will be eaten by us. And who will protest? Not the animals. Dogs may bark, yelp, or growl to voice their opposition at having some new product, a paint stripper, for example, or an improved oven cleaner, forced down their throats until they die in agony, tens of thousands killed this way year in and year out in the name of ensuring our safety. And other animals, depending on the species, will whine, groan, hoot, or scream in pain. But animals have no real power to protest. Who, then, will? People with a sense of justice will. Justice between humans is rooted in the recognition that no human being is to be treated merely as someone else's resource. Each human person is the experiencing subject of a life that matters to each as an individual. People with a sense of justice will protest, therefore, when the law or religion or other social forces allow or require that some human beings are to be treated as if they existed merely to serve someone else's interest. We humans, after all, have a right to be treated with respect. People with a sense of justice will affirm this same right in the case of those animals who, like us, are the experiencing subjects of a life and who, like us, have an individual welfare. The animals Americans routinely eat, hunt, trap, and use in science are like us in these morally crucial respects. We do not honor the rights of these animals by roasting or frying them, by blowing their insides to pieces with a high-powered rifle or ensnaring them in the cold cruelty of a lake-hole trap, by drowning, suffocating, or starving them to death in pursuit of scientific knowledge. Honor their rights? One might just as well say that plantation owners honored the rights of their slaves. There is no simple way to unravel the threads of tradition, greed, ignorance, and apathy that keep animals in their place. How shall we begin? In his writings, Leo Tolstoy extols the virtues of a life of simplicity, a life directed from within by the individual, rather than manipulated from without by the forces of custom and the latest fad. It is not easy, this journey to independence, but the integrity of our life depends on how earnestly we attempt to take it. How shall we begin? The first step, Tolstoy believes, is to abstain on principle from eating the flesh of animals. That step affirms our determination to take charge of our life, to remove the dead weight of tradition and habit from our back, and to help shoulder the burdens of the weak against the strong. And it is a step we can take again and again, as often as we sit down to eat. The journey of 1,000 miles has begun. To join Tolstoy and Ovid, Plutarch, Horace, Shelley, Shaw, Thoreau, Einstein, Schweitzer, Gandhi, and the other animal crazies who advocated vegetarianism for ethical reasons, to join them will not by itself bring down the powerful institutions that violate the rights of animals. That is 1,000 miles away. But it is a beginning, a first step, a step each one of us can take today on our own without having to wait for someone else to step forward. Though it does not end there, respect for the rights of animals begins with the food on our plate. If the lamb truly could talk, this is what she would tell us.
Tom Reagan is a professor at North Carolina State University. He's the author of The Case for Animal Rights, published by the University of California Press. Tom Reagan recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about moral philosophy. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The topic at hand is philosophy and public policy. Following Tom Reagan's commentary about animal rights, Soundings now presents a conversation with two other scholars at the National Humanities Center, Michael Bales of the University of Florida and Larry Temkin of Rice University. What contribution might philosophers make to public debate and understanding about issues such as American foreign policy? How does contemporary philosophy affect Americans' conceptions of ideas such as equality and fairness at home and overseas? Here are Larry Temkin and Michael Bales. First, Larry Temkin.
Well, when, for instance, people say that they care a great deal about equality, my own work is on the topic of equality. I'm trying to understand what it is people are caring about. And I find, as I think about it, well, let me step back to make it specific. There are two kinds of issues that most people seem these days to discuss when they discuss the topic of equality, at the academic level at least. And that is, what kind of equality should we care about at all? Do we want to care about equality of opportunity, equality of need satisfaction, equality of income, some other kind of equality? Or how much should we care about equality, or should we care about it at all? And you get what I call the boo-boo and yay-yay responses. Some philosophers who are busy arguing, oh, equality, great idea, let's care about it a lot. And other philosophers who say, no, there's no reason to care about equality itself, let's just care about other kinds of things. Two very simple, concrete examples. We all think about the examples of tyrants or bullies. We've all been in a class where, say, there was a gym teacher who picked on particular people in the class for no apparent reason except maybe to show the class that he's the boss. Now, if the gym teacher picked on, say, every single member of the class, made them all do push-ups or run extra laps afterwards, we would think that was bad, it was unfair, it was unjust. But we wouldn't think it was as bad as if he picked on, say, half the class. We wouldn't think it was nearly as bad as if he picked on that one short, fat, dumpy kid and made that person run after the class or do extra push-ups over and over and over. Now, these are very powerful intuitions that we have that we apply in many cases in our society. We care greatly, it appears, about when a single particular individual or small group is singled out for discrimination, and we call this terrible inequality. But notice what we have here. What we're saying is that the worst kinds of situation in this example is where a single individual or small group is singled out in this manner. On the other hand, if you ask a bunch of people in an audience, or you ask an audience, what are the worst periods of inequality in the history of the world, you get an answer which reflects a very different kind of concern. The typical answer you get is the Middle Ages. Well, what were the Middle Ages like? They were the times where you had a few people, the kings and queens, living like, well, living like what? Kings and queens, right? And the vast majority of the people down below living the lives of peasants. Now, here we say this is a terrible situation with respect to inequality. But you have the exact reverse, almost, of the kind of judgments we are making before. Instead of a single group or small, a single individual or small group being picked on, as it were, it's the vast majority of the population. And these reflect, this is just two examples, two very different kinds of concerns that we can have, that we both call egalitarian concerns. Mm-hmm. And they tell us very different things, both about what we do care about and what our policies perhaps should be, either towards, say, women's liberation, the black movement, obligations to third world nations. It makes a great difference.
Okay, so Larry Temkin, Michael Bales, what you're describing here is a search for all of the options. Michael?
One of the things that philosophers do, which I think you just stated, is clarify concepts, and frequently we use them in very confused ways, and that's part of what Larry is involved about. Until we get clear of the different things that we're talking about, then we can't really make intelligent decisions.
It's a series of definitions.
Yeah, and there are frequently confusions over that. I think the most prominent one in American society today is people don't know what a right is or the meaning of a right, mm-hmm. and it gets used in lots of different ways. And one of the things about getting them clear is then you can see what the implications of that are.
Right.
Now let me turn to third world situation. There are a lot of different views about equality and what's, let's say, fair or just with respect to differences in wealth around the world. And this affects how people look at the relationship between the United States and third world countries. One can have the view that basically start with a premise that everybody in the world ought to be basically equal and then allow for differences due to various sorts of factors. Or one can say, no, everybody has to go out and work for themselves, but they should have, let's say, have a fair opportunity to get ahead in the world. Or one can have another view that will apply fair opportunity, but everybody should have at least some minimum level of welfare. Now, all of these, or these three different conceptions, could all be taken as views about equality between developed and less developed countries, and they have rather significant differences for policy, foreign policy and aid and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Larry Temkin, let me follow up what Michael Bales has just said. From a philosophical standpoint, and I'm not asking you to make partisan judgments here, do you think that that the criticisms or the praises that American foreign policy gets, you know, in a philosophical sense, are they right? Are they wrong? Do the critics actually know what they're criticizing? And do the people who praise take into account all of the things that that should be taken into account when they talk about American attitudes and behavior toward the third world?
Well, I think that's also a very good question. I think that there are two responses I want to give to your question.
Okay.
I think one, at the theoretical level, I'm quite sure the answer is no.
They don't
that
take
is,
they were the critics as well as the praisers don't take everything into account.
I'm sure that that's right. I think that people tend not to be very careful in what they're lauding or what they're condemning.
Mm-hmm.
They lump together lots of different values at once, and they overlook many different values. So I think at the theoretical level, there's much room for improvement in understanding whether we should be praised or blamed.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, interestingly, that this is an area where some of the biggest mistakes in praise and blame of, say, American foreign policy just results from lack of good old-fashioned empirical knowledge about the way American foreign policy works and what we actually do or don't do with respect to other countries in this nation. I teach the topic of obligations to third world nations in some of my introductory philosophy classes, and I trot out a number of just statistics, a number of facts that the United States government prints every year in something called the U.S. Statistical Handbook. And it's shocking how little Americans know, even bright undergraduates, indeed shocking how little I knew before going to this book about what our policy really is. I did a careful analysis once of the statistics, and I found out of all the money that was given to foreign aid total in this year, I was referring to in the 1970s, out of a total of $15 billion, much less than $1 billion was given in purely humanitarian aid, as opposed to $210 billion in defense for that same year. That meant roughly that you would have to give the same amount as we are given in purely humanitarian aid for over 200 years, in fact, much, much more than 200, before you would have spent as much on just really helping the starving people of the world as we currently spend in 1 year on defense.
Michael Bales.
There's something I want to say about what Larry has just said, and that is that one of the other things that goes along is not simply helping, because he ended by saying that only so much had gone in actual humanitarian aid in terms of feeding people. And that is that there are theories about development. Theories change, and they've changed a lot in the last 20 years, and we've sort of gone from one theory to another theory and back around again. And these are theories about how one can, in fact, economically help these countries develop. And some of these theories suggest that, and a fair number of other people say, that simply giving direct food aid is not a good way to help people in the long run. Now, there have been a lot of differences of opinion about what kinds of policies will, in fact, end up having that in the long run. For a while, one of the major theories was, well, you've got to have a very wealthy upper class to develop in very poor countries until at least they have enough capital in that country to begin to trigger a vast development program.
So, in other words, the figures that generate the theories are form a sort of shifting sand underneath these policies. Larry, Temkin?
Yeah, can I just make one comment on that? I think that Michael is right to properly point out that the best way of aiding the underdeveloped countries is often not to just throw a lot of food at them. One wants to prevent starvation. The situation that's going on in Ethiopia is a genuine tragedy, and people ought to do something to help that now, but it's not enough to throw food or money at the problem. One has to try and do what one can to see that such things don't continue. And of course, it's not always America's fault. I mean, the government in Ethiopia has more to do with the starvation there than we do by far. In fact, interestingly, I think most of the hunger that goes on in the world now is mainly a result, I mean, completely a result of political problems and generally internal political problems. There's plenty of food. It's just that the divisions within countries, and here we come back to the issue of inequality,
right,
that divisions within countries are such that the people who most need the food don't usually get it. But I did want to say about the figures that I was just throwing out. One has to be very careful with figures. They're always misleading, or usually misleading.
Lies, damned lies, and statistics, huh?
Yes, indeed. But I was suggesting that when one took away, my purely humanitarian aid was even of the form of development aid for countries. It's not just food aid, but the point was that basically we operate on the principle that governments have operated on for thousands of years, and it's not a very noble principle. And the problem is there's a myth in America that we operate on the noblest of all principles. But the real principle that most of American policy is based on, and I'm not necessarily condemning it, but Americans ought to understand what it is the old-fashioned help your friends and hurt your enemies, or at least help your friends and don't help your enemies.
Right.
And whatever good political, pragmatic reasons there may be for such things, that is in fact the kind of principle we operate on. And the myth, and I think it is a myth, about what we do for the starving masses of the world is just that.
Let me follow up what Larry Temkin has just said and put a question to Michael Bales. Maybe Michael, Larry has just answered this question. Do you have any sense that the politicians listen to the philosophers?
It depends on the problem and the topic. I think a little bit less on international aid and perhaps more so on more specific types of issues.
You mean domestic issues?
Issues in biomedical ethics. We've had several commissions to look at issues in human experimentation and medical ethics, and these have had some philosophers as research assistants on them or sometimes on the commissions, and they've had a number of studies by philosophers that have fed into these into the reports and whatnot of the commissions. Now, in the United States, we have a nice long history of setting up presidential and commissions.
Blue ribbon panels.
Who do very good studies and are then totally ignored. They almost never have much influence in many ways.
Do you find this frustrating?
I think it's a characteristic of American politics in a way. They're set up to sort of take the heat off the politicians. Now, interestingly, since I just spent the last 5 years in Canada, they have a different technique there. to a large extent, when they get a very sticky problem, they appoint one judge who then conducts an inquiry into the issue and receives lots of information and reports. And in fact, those reports tend to be very influential. It was basically the work of one judge which established the and set the guidelines for the National Health Insurance Scheme in Canada. Hmm. And there have been other sorts of inquiries of that sort. Philosophers then have somewhat less influence at that level. I think, however, if one looks at it, when there are issues where philosophers really have done some work, they're perhaps as influential as others. One has to stop and think how many economists' views have actually affected the results of political decision-making and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. And one cannot expect sort of one group to suddenly dominate. Politicians have a lot of different things to trade off. People disagree, philosophers disagree, economists disagree with one another. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think at that level, one gets less influence. You've mentioned a couple of times options. Mm-hmm. I think that that's very important, and that's one of the things that philosophical thinking, I think, teaches one to do, is to look at alternative ways. And most of us, most of the time, tend to think that fail in our thinking because we only think of one or two possibilities. And I think this occurs in politics just as much as any other place. We don't try think of all the different alternatives that are available. And the failure to do that, I think, is one of the major problems in policy formation. We think, well, either we do A or we do B, and we forget that we could also do C, D, E, and F, or right. We can combine A and B in various ways and things of that sort.
Larry Temkin?
Well, I also think that people tend, in our society, particularly today's America, people are looking for the instant feedback.
Right.
Oftentimes, I hear from my students, well, what's in it for me if I take philosophy? What am I going to get? How are you actually affecting society today and now? And I do think that, as Michael, I think, is hinting at, I think philosophers have a lot to offer on these issues, and I think that we can and often do make a difference, I cited, say, in the case of the animal rights. But I think more often than not, the difference is in the long run. The difference is over a long period of time when the effects of a philosophy, of a generation, or of a civilization has time to work its way out. And I think, interestingly, I mean, this is certainly true historically of philosophy. I mean, today, our common sense philosophical intuitions about morality are largely the result, certainly not wholly, but of the Judeo-Christian tradition and of the traditions of people like Immanuel Kant, the famous mm-hmm. German philosopher, John Stuart Mill, the famous English philosopher. And these people didn't have this kind of tremendous effect at their time. They had an effect, but not such a tremendous effect. But over a long period of time, it begins to work its way in.
So Americans have a sort of short memory when it comes to the history of philosophy. And that underscores this desire for instant answers, right?
I think that's exactly right. I think the influence on Western civilization of people like Plato, Aristotle, or Locke, or Rousseau, or Kant, or Mill, has been absolutely enormous. I think, in fact, our daily lives from top to bottom have been enormously influenced, particularly at the political and social levels, not so much at the technical levels, but the political and social levels, mm-hmm. influenced in ways that are almost beyond comprehension.
Our notions of republics, our notions of social equality, our notions of justice, these are the things you have in mind.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Michael Bales, Larry Temkin, let's conclude. I remember hearing a story here at the Humanities Center about a philosopher, an academic philosopher, who was on an airplane and who got into a conversation with a seatmate who said, "What do you do?" And he said, in effect, "I'm a philosopher." And the response was, "Oh, really? Tell me some of your sayings." By way of that anecdote, let me ask you this. How do you view your obligation to what? To the society. How do philosophers think short-term, long-term, about what they do and the way it gets into the bloodstream? Larry Temkin?
Well, actually, your anecdote prompts me to start with another.
All right.
I lived in England for a year, and my father was living in America, and he came across a cartoon once, which he thought was perfect, and he sent it to me. And it was a picture of two gentlemen speaking to each other, and the one person said, "What does your son do?" The other one said, "Oh, he's a philosopher." The first one said, "Oh, I am sorry. And I do think in America there is a tendency to say something like, oh, you're a philosopher, or gee, that's too bad.
Right. And in one so young.
And in one so young, I said, shouldn't happen to me, right? Not my son. But I think there are two different levels. I do think that one of the reasons I'm in philosophy is because I think that there's perhaps a contribution that philosophers can make to the social fabric of our country. I think that we can help to think out carefully, perhaps clearly, perhaps with more time, not necessarily because we're any smarter, but because we're trained to think about certain kinds of problems in certain kinds of ways. But I do think that while that's very important and one of the main reasons I'm a philosopher, there is just another old-fashioned reason for being a philosopher. In fact, there's two other old-fashioned reasons for being a philosopher. One is because it's just plain fun. Mm-hmm. And one is because we're trying to do what people have been trying to do for a very, very, very long time. In fact, probably as long as people have been people, as opposed to animals, which is to understand ourselves in our universe and our place in the universe. And there's tremendous joy and satisfaction in doing that, even if there's no big bucks in it.
Right. Michael Vales?
I think philosophers now, let's say over 25 years or so ago, are now focusing more on concrete kinds of problems. It's called applied philosophy or applied ethics. And this is having more of an impact on sort of daily activities of people in various ways. And I suspect that this will continue for a good while. I don't think it's unusual. In the history of philosophy, most of the philosophical theories were generated by controversies of their time. Hobbes, great political philosopher, wrote at the time of revolution. Locke's treatise, and this is one of the things where I'm a little bit doubtful about some of the things Larry said, was written at the time of the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, and to develop a political theory for that time. So a lot of the work of philosophers has been pointed at general social problems of their times, and I think one cannot do it without some awareness of what the social conditions are, and in the end it may help. There is, however, I should say, the negative theory, which is that philosophers always come up with their theories to justify what's already happened. And I think that there's a fair amount of truth in that, more than I would like.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about philosophy and public policy. The Soundings panelists were Michael Bales of the University of Florida and Larry Temkin of Rice University. Michael Bales and Larry Temkin recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where each worked on research projects in philosophy. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Philosophy and Public Policy, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, Soundings presents a discussion about the 400th anniversary of the Roanoke Voyages and the first attempts at English colonization in the New World. My guests will be Karin Kupperman of the University of Connecticut and Helen Wallace, map librarian at the British Library. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a program about philosophy and public policy. Does philosophical inquiry affect the ways in which Americans and their leaders think and act about issues like civil rights, American foreign policy, the treatment of animals, and our notions of equality and fairness at home and overseas? Some answers and insights from scholars from the University of Florida, North Carolina State University, and Rice University. Philosophy and Public Policy, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.